May it please the court. My name is Patricia Meester and I represent Timothy Felder in this appeal. The plaintiff, Timothy Felder, was injured in an automobile accident when a drunk driver failed to yield at a stop sign and collided with the scooter that he was on. Mr. Felder was operating a scooter that was not listed on the farmer's insurance policy. It was a low-powered scooter that Mr. Felder believed didn't require insurance or registration or anything of that nature. Mr. Felder.
So there was no insurance, as far as the record reflects, on the scooter?
There was no individual independent policy that covered the scooter. That's correct, Your Honor. Mr. Felder sustained very significant injuries in this accident, multiple fractures. He was admitted to the hospital from the emergency room, and he incurred in excess of $180,000 in medical bills. The at-fault driver, the DUI driver, was insured with Fred Loya Insurance Company for the minimal limits in Colorado for $25,000. Fred Loya Insurance Company did tender that $25,000, but with $180,000 in bills, Mr. Felder turned to the farmer's policy for underinsured motorist coverage. His wife, Patsy Felder, she was the named insured under the policy with farmer's insurance coverage. That policy provided, you know, several parts. You know, part one was liability, part two was the underinsured and uninsured motorist coverage. Under part two, Mr. Felder, as the spouse who resided in the household, was extended that coverage under the policy.
Ms. Meester, you cite a definition as insured person, meaning you or a family member. Wasn't that definition only in the part of the policy that talks about liability coverage, or was there a similar definition applicable to UMUIM coverage?
I believe, Your Honor, that there was a another definition as part of the insurance policy, as part of the uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage. I believe that the insuring agreement for the policy in general did indicate that any resident relative of the household would be qualified, but I believe another section of the policy specifically said that it applied to the spouse who lived in the same household. And we'll double check that reference, Your Honor, because I certainly don't want to misrepresent anything. So when Ms. Felder took out the policy with Farmers, she agreed to exclude Mr. Felder from driving the vehicle that she was insuring. She insured three separate vehicles on that policy, and Mr. and Mrs. Felder both agreed that Mr. Felder would not drive any of those vehicles. Their understanding was that they were agreeing that he wouldn't drive those specific vehicles.
But you don't get to talk about extrinsic evidence like that unless you first establish that it's ambiguous, do you?
I agree, Your Honor, that first we have to establish it's ambiguous. But I think that once we establish that it's ambiguous, and I think it clearly is, that we get to that particular part that talks about the intent of the parties.
Just to put a nail on this discovery issue, intent of the parties, if it is ambiguous, isn't it, as a matter of law, construed against the insurer? So I guess I don't know why you need discovery either way.
I agree with that, Your Honor, as far as that if it's ambiguous, it must be construed in favor of Mr. Felder. I think that the issue of discovery and intent goes to the bad faith and unreasonable delay deny claims, and that, you know, the fact that this is ambiguous and the fact that they know this is ambiguous and the fact that they didn't, that their policy and procedure most likely is to obtain a specific endorsement and they didn't do that here, you know, that's where it becomes relevant and that's where that discovery is necessary.
So is your argument that because it is ambiguous, you win as a matter of law with respect to the breach of contract claim?
It is, Your Honor. It is. We believe that the policy is clearly ambiguous. And again, you know, I raised the issue of the intent of Mr. and Mrs. Felder in that it goes to the multiple reasonable meanings that can be, you know, that can occur here with the ambiguity. The policy, if you look at the policy itself, and the reason that we asked for oral arguments in this case is to really highlight, you know, two things. One is the policy itself. Nowhere in the actual policy is there any reference to the excluded driver or what that involves? The declarations page, which is part of the policy by definition, and the subscription agreement, they're very similar. They're almost identical to each other, one in the same almost. But if you look at the drivers, it says household drivers, and it says it lists Patsy Felder as a rated driver, and then it lists Timothy Felder, and it says excluded. And it's exactly the same on both the declarations page and the subscription agreement. Those are the only references in the policy itself that even use the word excluded, let alone define what it applies to. Now, we agree that, you know, excluded, we're not suggesting there's multiple meanings to the word excluded, but you have to put it in context. Where does the exclusion apply? Does it apply to the entire policy, as the defendant suggests, or does it apply only to Mr. Felder driving those particular vehicles as Mrs. Felder understood it to be?
Is the scooter a motor vehicle within the meaning of the policy?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and I don't believe it is. But for the purposes of underinsured motorist coverage, I'm not sure that that's relevant, other than, Your Honor, that just goes to show the ambiguity that, you know, does the excluded reference mean that he's excluded from driving a covered vehicle, or does it suggest, you know, would he be excluded as a pedestrian?
But your argument would be a lot stronger if Timothy had just been a passenger in the vehicle. Do you agree with that?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor, because I don't think that that's relevant to the analysis. If they had a proper exclusion, if they properly excluded Mr. Felder from any and all coverage, then it wouldn't matter whether he was a pedestrian, a passenger. He would be, we agree that the case law, that the statute allows farmers to exclude him from all coverages.
No, but isn't it a closer case? I mean, here, Timothy was driving, let's assume it was a motor vehicle, and he is listed as an excluded driver. You claim that's not clear enough to eliminate coverage in this factual context where he was driving, albeit not a vehicle insured by farmers?
Well, Your Honor, I understand your point, and certainly I agree that if he were a passenger, I wouldn't have to worry about that particular element. But again, I mean, the case law is very clear. If you look at Massengill, if you look at Colonial, the case law is very clear that if they want to exclude or limit coverage, they have to do it clearly and precisely. And here, just typing the word excluded next to his name doesn't make it clear that it applies to all coverage.
Ms. Meester, sorry to interrupt. I think you started earlier to explain what you think excluded certainly applies to. I know you think it's ambiguous as to everything else it applies to, but you do think it applies, excludes coverage where Timothy was driving a vehicle covered by this policy?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that it's vague in general.
So you don't think it's clear as to any possible set of facts? It's ambiguous as to every set of facts?
I think it's clear that there was some intention that he be excluded somewhere. And if you look at the certificate of liability coverage, one thing I'd like to point out with respect to that it's not part of the policy. Farmers is relying on the certificate of liability coverage to, for the statement that it applies to all coverages. But if you look at the certificate of liability coverage, which isn't part of the policy and shouldn't really be considered, but there the word liability is used 8 times.
So I want to follow up on Judge Navarro's question. So if Timothy had been driving one of the vehicles insured under Farmers policy, would you be here today?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that the exclusion clearly follows the liability. We believe that the exclusion, I use the term clearly very loosely. I don't think it's clear in any way, shape, or form. But the intent of the parties was that it would apply to the liability. The intent of the parties, if the Felders agreed that he would not operate any of those vehicles, and if he had been operating one of those vehicles, then he would not have been covered for liability coverage because he agreed he wouldn't.
So you agree that that's clear. There's at least one part of the exclusion that you think is clear. If he were driving a covered vehicle under this policy, he would not be entitled to a liability insurance.
We agree he would not be entitled to liability coverage, yes.
Okay, and just to put the final point on that then, so there's no question he's not entitled to liability coverage, but we're talking now about underinsured motorist coverage. And on that, does it really matter if he's driving anything or walking down the street?
It doesn't. He should be covered for that coverage regardless of what vehicle he's in.
Unless it's excluded.
Correct. And again, we don't disagree that they have a right to exclude him from that coverage, but that they have to do that clearly and specifically. And they failed to do that here. There's no endorsement. They could have listed, there's a notes section on the declarations page in the subscription agreement where they define additional terms. Nowhere there does it mention anything about that exclusion extending to all coverage. Where it's listed, it lists the drivers and then it lists the vehicles. And you know, it implies that he's excluded from these vehicles. To extend it beyond that would be to, you know, would be against public policy and would let them just throw a word out there and then claim later that it applies to everything. And there's nowhere, they have the duty to be very clear and specific that he's excluded from that coverage. To just say that, you know, well, it doesn't limit it to the liability coverage, that's not sufficient. They have not shown anywhere in the policy where it extends to all coverages. If there's no other questions, I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you. You have 3 minutes and 40 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good afternoon, members of the panel. Dan Fowler, Fowler, Schimberg, and Flanagan on behalf of Farmers, and Max Gadd was with me on the briefs here from our firm. The trial court gave a thoughtful and efficient February 3, 2014 order disposing of our motion for summary judgment, appellant's motion for determination of question of law, and the appellant's Rule 56F request for continuance to conduct some discovery. Through all of those, and as highlighted by the argument heretofore this afternoon, the core issue, of course, is the policy ambiguous in the use of the word excluded in the three separate policy documents, policy, subscription agreement, and certificate of liability insurance, when it uses the word excluded, or the documents use the word excluded under a heading of driver. We focused on the briefs on the word excluded.
Before you get to that, Mr. Feller,
yes, sir.
Do you agree that you are relying upon a policy exclusion? In other words, the exclusion of Timothy from coverage.
Yes, we are relying on the subscription agreement, which is part of the policy, actually precedes the issuance of the policy, and then the policy itself for Mr. Felder being an excluded driver.
And do you agree if we determine that that exclusion is ambiguous that you lose?
Under the circumstances of the motion, I don't think so. I think under the circumstances on a conclusion of ambiguity, at least the appellant has already argued in the court below and here that extrinsic evidence of intent ought be considered. While appellant has offered in the trial court in argument here some of her thoughts, or his thoughts, I guess, on intent.
But doesn't the law say that if you rely upon an exclusion, and if the court determines as a legal matter that it's ambiguous, that because of the nature of the insurance relationship, because you didn't clearly establish the exclusion, as a matter of law, there is coverage. Isn't that the law?
Yes, with the caveat that given the nature of the argument here for ambiguity, it seems to me there would have to be a remand if the ambiguity was finding was made or conclusion was made by this court based on the other claims that were disposed of along with the motion for summary judgment. And I would urge that if there were to be a remand under the circumstances of this case, while uncertainty ambiguity would be construed against farmers, the parties ought to be able to pursue the issue of intent, which was simply not explored at all, given the posture of the case in the court below. We'd start with two strikes against us for sure, but I don't know as though it's a strikeout here, simply based on that preliminary or provisional conclusion of ambiguity. Hopefully, I hope that answers the court's
question.
Can't
an appellate court look at a document as easily as a trial court to determine on its face whether the document is ambiguous?
Certainly, but then doesn't the trial court have to perform the fact-finding mission for all of us on whether or not that ambiguity is resolved by custom and usage between the parties, between the course of performance between the parties, whatever expressions of intent the parties can bring before the trial court, before the fact finder. We haven't had that. We're here on summary judgment. So neither side, I would submit, Your Honor, has had or made a full and fair presentation of what the extra contractual evidence of intent might be. The core ruling in the trial court being that of ambiguity, the core issue here is, does ambiguity exist or does it not? As I mentioned, the motion for determination of question of law was disposed of with the core issue in the trial court, with the trial court's conclusion that the automobile insurance policy issued by appellee, which excluded the appellant as a driver without limitation, was not ambiguous.
Could you, just so we can cut through this, just point to the exact language in the policy that excludes the appellant as from UIM, from UM-UIM coverage? I understand the language has said, you know, he's not covered for liability driving these vehicles, but I'm looking for that specific language that says he doesn't get UM-UIM coverage.
I don't think there's anything that says he doesn't get UM-UIM coverage. There is the policy document, which was the subject of a issue of fact skirmish in the
you
trial
mean the
court.
The certificate of liability.
The certificate of liability.
Now, is that considered part of the policy for our purposes in assessing ambiguity?
It's delivered with the policy, and it very clearly and unambiguously states all coverages.
Doesn't it say certificate of liability?
It does, by title. But in the body of the document, which was Exhibit D to the motion for summary judgment, mm-hmm. in the body of the document, it states, while it's called certificate, it's clearly the form we're all obliged by law to have with us in our glove boxes or wherever. Each one of the three copies of the same certificate that is Exhibit D states, keep this certificate in your vehicle at all times. And each one of those three copies pretty clearly states the coverage provided by this policy does not apply to the operation of any vehicle by a person named here.
Okay, to the operation of any vehicle. So if he'd been walking down the street and he was hit by an uninsured motorist, he might have still had coverage?
Sure, that issue wasn't briefed or considered by the court below or the parties, but the other possibility that is, you know, maybe in our modern times more probable would be the scenario where he's riding with Mrs. Felder
sure,
in one of the family vehicles that he's excluded from, and the definition of insured family member would seem to have equal applicability. As I say, it's not been briefed or considered by either side of the dispute.
Mr. Feller, I'm confused now. Are you claiming that there's no UIM coverage because Timothy was driving a scooter as opposed to being a passenger in a vehicle?
We claim and have denied on the basis that he was operating a vehicle.
Even a vehicle that was not covered by the policy?
Correct.
So it doesn't matter whether he's walking or driving. But if he's driving a vehicle that's not covered by the policy, he's excluded.
Or he would be equally excluded, Your Honor, if he was driving one of the three vehicles that was covered by the policy.
Okay.
Judge Casebolt gave us a great template with the Massengill case in terms of UM-UIM coverages a few years back. And there, in distinguishing D. Herrera from the Massengill situation, he and the panel in that case made it very plain D. Herrera is different because D. Herrera is saying you can't comply with Colorado UM-UIM statute and public policy by picking out that vehicle. Why? Because UM-UIM coverage is the coverage that follows the person.
But wasn't the language in Massengill that Judge Casebolt construed much more specific than the language you're relying upon here?
I think so, and I think that's the, we didn't make a big deal of Massengill in our briefing, Judge Berger, for that very reason. Factually, it's not on all fours. And I think where appellant and appellee drifted apart, if you will, in the pre-suit and the trial court phase of this dispute was on interpretation of the policy, with probably both of us separately looking at the Massengill template. The key part of the template there was a separate endorsement, apparently, at least as I read the opinion, there was a separate endorsement that excluded Brian Massengill, I think he was a Massengill, that excluded the driver Brian because of his driving record. And certainly it had a great deal more language. I think that's what led to the interpretative difference between us. I've always followed appellant's argument to be you can't possibly have properly excluded Timothy Felder from this policy, Farmers, because you didn't do it the way it was done in Massengill, even though the way it was done really wasn't the issue in Massengill. And the language in Massengill is actually very helpful, appellee asserts, to its cause. The way Judge Casebolt described it, at 176 P3 816, he actually says the insurer may construct a policy that frees it from liability for damages, losses, or claims arising out of the operation of the motor vehicle by the excluded driver. And nowhere in the opinion, obviously, because it wasn't before that court, nowhere in the opinion does the Court of Appeals, speaking through Judge Casebolt, say, you've got to do it this way. To like effect, the driver exclusion statute that both appellant and appellee have brought to the court's attention provides absolutely no roadmap. There is no cookbook formula or cookbook recipe that says you must do it this way so many days before policy issuance and using these words. What the current statute, which was referred to as the former 10-4-721 in Massengill, said was the company could may exclude a driver, quote, from coverage by name. That's exactly what's been done in three places in the documents supporting appellee's motion for summary judgment.
Mr. Fowler, let's accept for purposes of argument that the insurer could do this. The question is whether the insurer actually did this in this agreement. And I want to take you back to Judge Vogt's question about the certificate of liability. You relied on sort of the general language in the body of that certificate, which excluded the listed driver from coverage under the policy. But wouldn't the most natural reading of that sentence be excluded from liability coverage only, since it's under a big heading that says certificate of liability? Why would we assume it applies to any other coverage given the plain language of that certificate?
The plain meaning of the more specific words, all coverage, in the body of the document?
Couldn't it mean all liability coverage? That's also consistent with the plain meaning of all, given that's under the big banner that says certificate of liability.
It certainly could. And if
it's at least ambiguous, it seems.
Well, I'm not sure that the title and then a full sentence in the insurance card Ms. Felder undoubtedly carried around in her three insured vehicles is sufficient to create an ambiguity where none otherwise exists. Judge Egelhoff in the court below clearly started with the policy in his analysis, his February 3, 2014 order, and carefully pointed out in both the policy and in the subscription agreement signed by Ms. Felder that excluded driver, that Mr. Felder was not a named insured in either document, and that he was excluded driver in both documents.
Which of the three documents most strongly supports your position?
I would say, Judge Berger, the policy itself and the subscription agreement are co-equals. The policy simply because it's the driving document, but the subscription agreement because Ms. Felder signed off on it. She knew she couldn't insure Mr. Felder under the same policy. And just as counsel has acknowledged here today in response to Judge Navarro's questions, that the policy was not ambiguous in terms of an excluded driver, at least for the liability coverage. I would say those two are co-equals and work together. If you got to make me choose one, I think I'd probably have to go with the subscription agreement because it was first in time. That's the document that Ms. Felder and the agent got together on when there was this issue of we have an excluded driver. If we were to consider Mr. Felder at all as an insured, it would be at a much greater premium, or we're excluding him altogether, and Ms. Felder elected and signed off and acknowledged that indeed Mr. Felder was an excluded driver. And I see that my sands in the hourglass have run
out.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just like to address a couple of quick things. Mr. Felder keeps referring to three separate policy documents, and I'll refer you to the policy itself, Part 5, which specifically says that this policy with the declarations includes all agreements between you and us relating to this insurance. Nothing else is part of the policy. The declarations page is part of the policy by definition, but the subscription agreement that he keeps referring to, as well as the certificate of liability coverage, you know, those aren't really parts of the policy. You know, for him to continue to imply that there's three separate policy documents that address this is inaccurate. But even so, if you look at the certificate of liability insurance, you know, as Your Honors have pointed out, it's a certificate of liability insurance. It's multiple times does it say liability, 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 repeatedly. It says the coverage provided by this policy, meaning the certificate of liability insurance. So nowhere in this policy is there any suggestion that the exclusion extends beyond the liability. To extend it on our own would be an unfair violation of public policy. We do ask that you find as a matter of law that the policy is ambiguous. Your honors have asked very good questions. Well, you know, would he be covered if he were a passenger? Would he be covered if he were a pedestrian? And we don't know the answers to those questions. That's what makes this policy ambiguous. You know, we can guess that maybe that's what they intended to do, but we shouldn't have to guess. It's ambiguous as to what is excluded and when, and because nobody sitting here today can even answer the questions of when it would apply and when it wouldn't, it's by nature ambiguous. Because the policy provision is ambiguous, we do ask that you find as a matter of law that the policy must be construed in favor of Mr. Felder and that the underinsured motorist coverage, you know, must be provided to him, you know, and that the case be remanded to the district court to determine, you know, intent as far as, you know, the bad faith and unfair, unreasonable delay claims only. you know, Mr. Felder points out, or I'm sorry, Mr. Fowler points out that the Massengill court doesn't require that you do it a particular way, and we agree with that. But the Massengill court does recognize and acknowledge that it has to be clear and precise if you're going to exclude that coverage. It's not clear here. It's not precise. They could have done it the way the Massengill insurer did it. They didn't. They could have done it in a number of ways. They could have put it in the notes section. They could have put it in the declarations page. They could have, added a specific exclusion to the policy.
What would be the result here if Farmers had done it precisely as it was done in the Massengill case?
Then we wouldn't be here today, Your Honor. Then we would agree that they have a right to exclude coverage, and we would agree that the Felders would have been on notice that that was inclusive of all of the coverages of the policy. They may, by law, by case law, by statute, they may exclude that coverage. They may exclude him from receiving any coverage under the policy. They may do that, but they did not do that here. And had they done it the way the Massengill court did it, then we wouldn't be here today. It wouldn't be ambiguous. But because they didn't do it that way, it's ambiguous, and it shouldn't be determined that it extends beyond what it on its face does. I appreciate your time, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you for your excellent arguments, counsel. The case is submitted, and we will issue a written opinion. That completes our docket today, so the clerk may announce the recess.